This week on Making Contact. More than two decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall, what have we learned about barriers that separate people? In dozens of countries around the world, millions of people live beside border walls. These heavily militarized and closely watched areas can be dangerous places to be.
Why did not turn off your vehicle?
Why is that?
Because I'm asking you to turn it off.
Why is that?
Because we're going to inspect your vehicle.
This is no right to do that, so.
It's all right.
It's our land, not your land.
On this edition, from Palestinian farmers struggling to make a living next to the Israeli wall, to shootings at the fence that divides the US and Mexico. Living in the shadow of the wall. I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. The US-Mexico border runs over 2,000 miles. Some of that border is open, some has fences, and some has a high wall separating the two countries. Construction of the wall has been a high-profile and costly step that the government says is aimed at securing the borders and stopping undocumented immigration. But the October 2012 fatal shooting of a Mexican teenager on the border led many to question whether the militarization of the border has gone too far. Reporter Caroline Jackson brings us this story.
The street corner in Nogales, Sonora, where 16-year-old Elena Rodriguez was shot, is marked with bullet holes. Across the street is an imposing border wall, constructed in 2011, that snakes its way across the terrain, separating Mexico from the U.S. The teenager was shot dead by a U.S. Border Patrol agent, who later claimed that Rodriguez had been throwing rocks at them. But some, like Isabel Garcia, questioned that story.
He had to have stuck his rifle in there and sprayed him. And he was blown away, let me tell you, by 12 shots or, you know. We don't know who the shooter is, and they're going to keep quiet for how long?
Garcia is co-chair of Derechos Humanos and has been speaking out against border abuses in the Tucson area since 1976. Elena Rodriguez was shot just a few blocks from his home on the Mexican side by an officer standing on the U.S. side of the border. At least 16 people have been killed by Border Patrol since 2010. Many of them were alleged to be throwing rocks. The Border Patrol denied a request to be interviewed, but in an emailed statement said,
Customs and Border Protection law enforcement personnel are trained to use deadly force in circumstances that pose a threat to their lives, the lives of their fellow law enforcement partners, and innocent third parties.
Garcia says that the situation on the border has deteriorated ever since responsibility for immigration control was handed to the Department of Homeland Security back in 2003.
It's a whole different thing now to get things from Department of Homeland Security. So everybody is viewed through the lens of a potential threat to Homeland Security, so therefore they think they can kill them.
Apart from the shootings, she says the border cost many people their lives.
Our policies are just brutal, whether it's the brutal kind that we're hiring agents that are totally out of control and killing people, or whether it is, you know, the more quiet way that we don't feel so responsible. We just push them all out into the desert, and then they die. A horrific death as well.
Until 2009, crossing the border between the Twin Cities of Nogales didn't even require a passport. Now there is beefed up security, and a new, higher wall has replaced one from the 1990s. 6 days a week, volunteers from Tucson-based organization No More Deaths provide free phone calls and support to migrants who have been recently released from Border Patrol custody. Operating out of a small concrete building, on a cold day, it is warmer outside than in. A handful of the 25 or so migrants are gathered around a small space heater, swapping stories about La Migra. Martin says he attempted to cross the desert into America to find work as a carpenter, but turned himself into the Border Patrol because he could no longer walk.
I asked for medical attention for my knees, and they didn't want to provide it. I don't know why they didn't want to provide it. And then they were demanding that I walk, but because I couldn't walk, they pulled me, kind of dragged me to move.
A handful of women say they don't know where their husbands are and are calling the consulate to get answers, but the consulate doesn't have any information from Border Patrol. Another says he felt pushed into signing documents he couldn't read because they were in English. When they formed in 2004, No More Deaths' goal was to provide aid to migrants. But while working along the border, they heard stories of migrant abuse in Border Patrol detention facilities. They collected accounts and have put out two reports of their findings. Hannah Hafter was the co-author of those reports. She moved to Tucson with the intention of helping undocumented people. Hapter sees stories about abuses in detention and the border shootings as related.
I think that any situation which allows for minor abuses naturally leads to extreme forms of excessive use of force. So I think that something like people being pushed into a cactus shows a disrespect for human life and dignity that then comes out by shooting to kill in the face of rock throwing that may or may not have even happened, and certainly did not put anyone in danger if it was happening in the context of Jose Antonio and Elena Rodriguez.
After his shooting, the family and friends of Elena Rodriguez carried his white coffin alongside the border fence in Nogales. His mother says she will not allow his death to be forgotten. Hannah Hafter says many Americans don't want to know what's happening on the border.
It's very hard to admit that these things are happening in the name of our government and in our names with our own tax money. And so I think a lot of people don't want to believe just how bad it is and just how little accountability and oversight there is in Border Patrol.
Isabel Garcia agrees and says public conversation in the U.S.
has been poisoned, especially in Arizona, since 1994, particularly against the immigrants. So it's become a real toxic place. So when you demonize people and then they're killed, well, who cares? So that's what permits it. We permit it. We're all responsible. I'm responsible. You're responsible. We ultimately are all responsible for this kind of injustice that's going on. It's our government.
And as long as the U.S. government maintains a militarized border with Mexico, groups like No More Deaths and Derechos Humanos say they will work to build solidarity across the walls. For Making Contact, I'm Caroline Jackson in Arizona.
Joining us now is Alex Soto, a Tono Otom activist and musician from the community of Cells, not far from the U.S.-Mexico border. He's a member of the Otom Solidarity Cross Borders Collective and an MC with the hip-hop duo Shining Soul. Alex Soto, could you describe what life is like for people living in the border area?
As far as Otom, you know, Tono Otom, you know, how it is, you know, where I'm from, you know, it's a desert, you know, it's not developed, it's just wide-open plains, wide-open desert, you know, mountains, you know, all the beauty of the land, the beauty of the desert. And one way, it seems like there's nothing going on because it's so calm. It's so, you know, this naturally has natural order of things. But along with that, though, we have, you know, a huge presence of Border Patrol agents, a huge presence of this, the overall militarization of our communities. And that right there, you know, is disturbing that peace.
On this program, we've heard about the militarization of the border, and in particular, allegations of abuse by the Border Patrol. How has the border affected you and your community?
We have, you know, in my own lifetime, you know, I'm only 27 years old, and, you know, when I was younger, you know, these areas, which is, you know, which is the line, you know, the international line, I remember going there as a young man, a young person, you know, with my grandparents, and they would have trade with the Mexicans on the other side, and there was no border wall. There was nothing there. It was just a, maybe at best a chicken wire fence that was only for cattle. And fast forward 15 years later, now that area you can't even gather like that. You have to have either your tribal ID. So on that level, you know, it affects us because now we have to have some type of identification, an ID, a paper, you know, something that's supposed to give us permission just to be at our own land. So that's how it's one area, and that spans not just in, you know, that particular border crossing, you would say, but overall, you know, deeper, more north into the more on the U.S. side, you know, just traveling home or, you know, going down the state highway and, you know, getting potentially pulled over, harassed, you know, for not doing nothing other than just driving either home or to work. Or, you know, for basic, you know, everyday traveling that anybody would do anywhere else. So we have to deal with the scrutiny of Border Patrol agents and then also having checkpoints off all major routes off the reservation. We have one that's in the northern part that goes, you know, before you get off, where they have pretty much like a mini base, you know, with cameras and, you know, all types of surveillance type of gear. A row of cameras when you, you know, you get to the checkpoint, a row of cameras after the checkpoint, which, you know, we're totally unaware exactly what's the purpose of this other than, you know, tracking us and you know, harassing us. So this, these many factors, you know, are definitely a hurdle. They're definitely attacking us, you know, every day to be who we are.
And your group Shining Soul wrote a song that was about many of these issues. Let's take a listen to a clip from that now.
Up in the city, y'all know the deal. But back on my reservation, it's been the ordeal. Red light, blue light, keep still. Checking for ID, you get the ideal. Who your family be, where your papers at? Don't it sound like a chopper screw track? Feds on my back taking photos. Border patrol equals the stop boat. They have to get ya. I'm just minding my biz. Officer tripping like a Lambie. Here's pop quiz. How did we let it get this far? Spy drones got me on radar. Star Trek lights at night. Mine is Picard all up in my backyard. The National Guard and the Frontierer, we under attack. Time to do it like me and my two can fight back. It's like that.
That was a clip from the track Papers by Shining Soul. Alex Soto, tell us why it was important for you to write that song.
Myself is, you know, I currently live in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, as was mentioned, I'm from the community itself, but I've also spent a great time of my life living in Phoenix, Arizona. And, you know, through that, I was able to be introduced to hip-hop culture, you know, emceeing in particular. And, you know, I'm keeping it as real as I can be to myself and to my community and my people. So that's why I felt the need to, you know, in that particular song, describe some of what I've already been describing today on this broadcast, everyday, you know, a glimpse into what we face and what we have to, I would say, maybe prepare ourselves to do or take action on. A lot of people don't know about our struggle. A lot of people don't know about what we're seeing every day, feeling every day. And through the power of hip-hop and MCing, I wanted to convey that, to be able to share not just to my own people, to other young people and other authors so they can be empowered to speak out, but also to you know, people off the reservation. So that was why I wrote that, along with my other MC in my group, who's Chicano. He wanted to also share his part of it, because as a person who is Mexican or Chicano, you know, to show that solidarity and that support, to be able to, you know, relate that, you know, it's bigger than just the border. It's bigger than just SB 1070 or Sheriff Joe or these issues that attack us.
And Alex Soto, you're also part of a group called the Autumn Solidarity Across Borders Collective. Tell us why that group formed.
As Autumn, you know, our land is not just on the Thun Autumn Reservation. You know, that's one tribe of Autumn, because our traditional Autumn land spans from the Phoenix area down to the Thun Autumn Nation along the border and past the border all the way to into by Hermosillo into the ocean and Rocky Point. So the reason we felt the need to establish this group was to show that common link between us as Autumn. You know, myself, Thono Autumn, you know, translates to people of the desert. But the Autumn who live by Phoenix and Salt River and Hiller River, they're the Acamel Autumn, they're the river people. And, you know, in our ways, our cultures, you know, of course, we're in different areas geographically, but we carry, you know, our language is the same, our stories are very similar. We are, you know, that's our tribe, you know. So that's why we felt the need to have a group, a space to show solidarity, where a lot of times, you know, our people sometimes get caught up in these borders, you know, beyond the international, but more so like, oh, you're from the Thun Autumn Reservation, or you're from Hiller River, or you're from all these different tribes, you know, or different areas. And it's like, well, we're all the same. You know, we speak the same language, literally, you know. So that's why we formed that group, to hopefully address, you know, the bigger picture. For example, the border, you know, obviously affects that. In our reservation, 79 miles, you know, we're affected by that. But there's a bigger context of why they're trying to, you know, insert themselves into our land on an everyday basis.
And what kind of organizing does the Autumn Solidarity Across Borders Collective do?
What we do is basically, you know, support, you know, our elders, our youth. You know, there's a lot of community events that go on. Example, there's the Unity Run, Autumn Unity Run, which is a run, a seven-day run where it runs from Phoenix to Mexico, you know, as was mentioned, that connection. But that's just how, like, the essence of the group is to basically support and provide solidarity as much as we can. We put ourselves out there more so to pretty much hopefully push the dialogue, or just where the struggle's at. As an example, in 2010, we were part of the Border Patrol occupation in Tucson, Arizona, at the Border Patrol station. At the Air Force base out there.
Human rights activists protesting the militarization of the border are targeting the Tucson Border Patrol headquarters.
KLB News 13's Teresa Jen joining us live from outside the gate of the East Side headquarters.
So myself and five others, I was part of that action. And along with other, you know, Latinas, queer youth, anarchists, Chicanos, it was an action to bring that awareness about the bigger struggle of militarization. And that was in light of the SB 1070, a state law that was passed months before and really got the immigration activist community going. But the thing was about what they're mobilizing and they're organizing was projecting was not in any way in solidarity with the first people of the land, in particular where I'm from, Zona Autumn, because a lot of the mainstream immigration organizing caters towards reform. It caters towards policies that may grant quote-unquote citizenship to undocumented people, if you agree with that term, undocumented, but at what expense? You know, the trade-off would be, oh, we have to militarize or secure, you know, the border, meaning militarization. So that was an action that we did to fiercely push back on not just the state, but also overall the left or the more progressive, more reformist elements of the struggle.
And how successful do you think the group has been at bringing together these struggles for indigenous sovereignty and against immigration controls?
We have a long way to go in terms of that discussion. I have to always remind myself, along with the few volunteers that we have, you know, it's one of those things where we definitely know what needs to be done. We definitely know the bigger context of these struggles, as you know, I've been sharing. But a lot of it also comes back to this community empowerment. It's one of those things in the community we all know. We all know what needs to be done. But it's another thing to also implement that. We try our best to really literally destroy all borders in the bits between more progressive, reformist forces out there. We've always been able to provide that space to say, hey, we all these things are connected. All these things, if we come together, we can do more than what's out there. I really feel it's happening. It's just taking that time and progress to really become stronger.
We'll hear more from Alex Soto later in the program. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and Australia. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We go now to Gaza, where high-security fences and walls surround the entire strip, which is home to more than 1.5 million people. An Israeli-controlled buffer zone surrounds the wall on the Palestinian side. That off-limit zone occupies a large part of Gaza's scarce farmland. In the ceasefire that followed the November 2012 conflict between Israel and Gazan militants, reporter Rami Al-Magari went to talk with some of those living and working near the Israeli-controlled border.
With the help of local youth from Beit Hanun, a town in the north of the Gaza Strip, 50-year-old Majid Wahdan is cultivating his farmland for the first time in 4 years.
I haven't been able to approach this area before, and no one else has been here either, as everyone who approaches it could be shot and killed. Under the ceasefire, we've managed to come back here to sow grains.
Majid is still cautious as Israeli army soldiers in watchtowers sit just 400 meters away from his long-abandoned farmland. Between 2008 and 2012, Majid says he was not able to farm his land because the Israeli army enforced buffer zone 300 meters from the fence.
Even after the ceasefire, they continued shooting at people next to the border. For example, yesterday an Israeli military jeep approached some shepherds who happened to be about 100 or 200 meters away from the border fence and forced them to leave.
Often the consequences for people in the buffer zone can be much worse. In June 2012, 24-year-old Mohammed Qdeh had half of his right leg and three of his fingers blown off when an Israeli drone fired a missile into his farmland, 900 meters from the fence.
They used to open fire in the area while we were working with our olive trees, forcing us to hide. But this time, they hit me with the rocket.
Qdeh's story is not uncommon. Gazan Health Ministry officials estimate that since 2001, dozens of people have been killed near the Israeli enforced buffer zone. Many of them were farmers. Israel has been developing the fence and buffer zone since 1967. Now it's a 40-kilometer-long electric fence that surrounds Gaza to the north and east. The Israeli army will shoot anyone who touches the fence or enters the buffer zone.
When we speak to the buffer zone, we don't speak only to the 300 meters from the borders or the fence.
That's Dr. Nabil Abu Shamala, Director General for Planning at the Gaza Agricultural Ministry.
We speak about more than 1 kilometer, because for us, the buffer zone, it is not the zone that the access is totally forbidden. But there is some buffer zone. Agricultural activity is restrictive. That means it is not allowed for farmers to plant trees, for example.
Gaza's agricultural sector has lost between $50 to $60 million as a result of the fence and buffer zone, which annexes some of the most productive agricultural land in the Gaza Strip. According to Dr. Abu Shamala, 6,000 acres of farmland have been abandoned since 2001, representing 20% of all the agricultural land in Gaza.
The eastern area of Gaza Strip is very suitable for field crops and for fodder crops. So I think our objective is to minimize the fodder importation. The second objective is to increase our improve our food security through food self-sufficiency. We will sustain our food self-sufficiency from the rainfed area in this rainfed crops in this area. Some of this area, especially in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, grazing area, so that the access of this area will improve the grazing area and will enhance the animal production sector in Gaza Strip.
For now, Gaza is far from agricultural self-sufficiency. Since the Israeli blockade began, Gaza has relied on products from Israel. Many farmers are struggling just to feed their own families. Just southeast of Beit Hanun, in the Farahin region, Zahra Abu Dakka, a local farmer in her late 50s, also struggles to survive beside the wall. She has been farming all her life and is the sole provider for her 10-member family.
I used to plant field crops and vegetables or citrus. I had my olive and citrus trees uprooted by the Israeli army back in 2008. For the past 7 years, I have been unable to access my farmlands. Even now, after the ceasefire, I came back to the farmland, but when I saw the military jeeps on the border, I was afraid and returned home.
Zahra supports 6 grown children, including 2 university students, and says that farming is needed in order for her and her children to get by. Despite the risks, some farmers continue to work on their lands, and they are calling on other Palestinians and international supporters to join them. back on Majid Wahdan's land, Palestinian and international activists work with him to plant the wheat. Their presence, a show of solidarity as well as a deterrent against Israeli attack. Among them is Sabir Zaanin, a frequent figure in the struggle against Israel's border fence. Zaanin says he is hopeful that eventually Gaza's farmers will be able to work without fear.
Our aim is freedom, justice, and peace. We call upon all free people around the world to help us attain this. My message to all those resisting apartheid, and for the sake of freedom, is that all forms of resistance are legitimate, and we should not stop resisting racism and apartheid. All apartheid walls will eventually be removed.
That was a report by Rami Almagari in Gaza. Still with us is Alex Soto, a Tono Otom activist and musician. Alex Soto, do you see a connection between the struggles against the walls in Gaza and on the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yes. Just like what's going on in Gaza, I mean, what's happening, it all comes down to colonization, you know, colonialism, imperialism, implementing policies like that. So, I mean, of course, here in the States, we were, as Native people, we know directly how that feels.
And we know that some of the same companies were involved in building both walls, as well as supplying them with the security and surveillance infrastructure. What's your opinion on that?
To me, that this reveals the bigger shroud, which is that of capitalism, you know, global capitalism. You know, in this case, a corporation profiteering off the militarization of native land, let alone sacred land in that area, with no remorse. You know, it's just, hey, we're going to make money. And then along with that, that infrastructure that they're placing is also a means to also create or protect more capital or more infrastructure. You know, a border wall is for regulation. You know, why do, you know, here, these, you know, I could speak on out here, you know, why are they building a wall? You know, besides the fact about, oh, we want to not have people cross, you know, all the more of the mainstream dialogue, you know, it's to pretty much regulate trade, you know, so there's definitely a connection there between capital and why they're doing this. And I'm sure, I mean, I don't know all the exacts in that area, but of course, this comes down to land, it comes down to resources, it comes down to the various things that the state, you know, wants, you know, compared to just, you know, letting be and respecting. I mean, just the fact that you have a corporation that's building a wall where I'm from, you know, and just in a native community, let alone thousands of miles away in Israel, I mean, I don't think that's a coincidence. That's very clear that these people are attacking, you know, the heart of this humanity.
Alex Soto, thank you for speaking with Making Contact.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.